following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys. And then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Okay, I think it's time to take a nap because I'm exhausted. If only I could. You know, sleep is something that doesn't come easily these days. And when I do fall asleep, I wake up very quickly going, oh my God, what the hell is going on? And we have a busy show for you today, so I'm going to jump right in. But first, I got to say, I'm watching the world fall apart in Kazakhstan. And normally, you know, Kazakhstan, it's on the other side of the world. But you may know I adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan and we were there 21 years ago and it was charming and wonderful. And now it's burning. It looks like the new president of Kazakhstan is calling in some help from his pal Vladimir Putin. So, you know, the world is just falling apart all around us. Gee, aren't we lucky? Anyway, welcome to a Wednesday. Today is the 5th of January, meaning tomorrow is the 1-year anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And, there's all kinds of posturing going on. Here in Florida, as I like to call it, things are even more insane than ever. And in fact, we're gonna kick things off right now with a Florida guest, although he's not duh. His name is Ron Philipkowski. Am I pronouncing it correctly, Ron?
Got it right.
Ron Philipkowski. And
I met Borat from Kazakhstan.
Borat was from Kazakhstan, but okay. But not really. It was supposed to be. And the thing I was happiest about when that movie came out is that my daughter at the time was too young to know what it was, because it did not paint a very flattering picture of Kazakhstan. From what I understand, they really didn't film it there because it didn't paint a nice picture of Kazakhstan. I think the filming they did outside of this country was in Romania, so it wasn't even really Kazakhstan. But Kazakhstan's a fun country to poke fun at because of the name, and despite the fact that it's huge, it is bigger than all of Western Europe combined.
Wow.
Doesn't have a huge population, but it's situated right between Russia and China. And there's a lot of oil there. And that's what this is all about. They raise the price of energy, of their liquid natural gas or something that they're using for cars over there. And it just got out of hand and it's a mess. Mm. So I'm looking at pictures online and video of in the city of Almaty. There was gunfire and looting and all that. It's just, I guess we can't escape it anymore. This is life in the 21st century, I suppose.
Right.
Anyway, Ron, thank you so much for joining us today. I met you on the Twitter machine. Your Twitter bio reads, attorney, Marine, triathlete, historian, former federal prosecutor and Republican, now defense attorney and Democrat, tracking and reporting on right-wing extremism. And you are here in Florida, as I call it. You're in the Sarasota area, which is like the Tampa Bay area. You're on the West Coast, about halfway up the state. I'm on the East Coast in the South. I'm in Broward County. So for those not here, a suburb of Fort Lauderdale. And the one thing, you know, you posted a video earlier today of the governor, who the man I like to call moron death sentence. And he was doing, I guess he was missing in action for like 2 weeks. And when he was called out on it, they got all, his wife has cancer and he went with her to a treatment. That's understandable. Treatment, chemotherapy session lasts a couple of hours, one day. That doesn't explain where he was for the whole 2 weeks he was missing in action. And I surmise that he probably came down with COVID. Well, do you know where he was for those 2 weeks?
Well, like most authoritarians, he's very secretive about his schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And we always catch him. Sometimes we'll catch him out of state, you know, in New York, or we've caught him in Michigan and Ohio, Nevada, where he didn't even announce to anybody in Florida that he was leaving the state.
Right.
Now, there are some states where whenever their governor leaves the state, the lieutenant governor is acting governor. Okay. I mean, there's actually a transition of power. We saw that when the Arizona governor went to Europe.
Right.
Doug Ducey went to Europe. The lieutenant governor, who was a Democrat, became the governor of Arizona for 2 weeks. So, I mean, it's kind of a big deal when the governor just kind of disappears, especially for a huge state like Florida. But he does it all the time.
Yeah.
But this one was longer than normal. And there was like 3 days of everybody just saying, where's Ron? Where's Ron? Where's Ron? And nobody answered.
Right.
And then finally we got the story of, well, he was with his wife and, you know,
first we heard he was on vacation, right? Didn't we? First they
that
said
was the first story. Yeah. You never get exactly a straight answer.
No.
About anything schedule wise. He's very obstructionist with the press, you know, as you know.
We know. Yes. Just yesterday he had a guy removed from a press conference in a public building. This guy is an activist. He's like a peace activist. He's very well known in the Jacksonville area, and he right. wasn't doing anything wrong. He wasn't upsetting anything. He was just there. And when they said, you have to leave, he said, well, it's a public building. This is a public press conference. And they had him removed. They handcuffed him. They put him in the back of a car. This is reprehensible. This is how Ron DeSantis treats people. You posted a video a little while ago of Ron DeSantis today. He's, I don't know where he is, somewhere in the state, giving, I don't know if it was a press conference or a speech or something, but you mentioned in your tweet that he doesn't look very good and he sounds even worse. Here's a little bit of the video that you posted and people can see and hear.
Manager, Skywater, Florida, and Dale Miller, site director, Skywater, Florida.
He doesn't sound right.
As well as representative.
Not that he ever sounds right, but he sounds more wrong than usual.
Manufacturing is something that we need to do better job of. And we've worked really hard in Florida.
Okay, that's enough of him. We don't need to dwell on him. But I think he's got the COVID.
Yeah, you know, I don't speculate. I just put it out there for people to
judge. I can speculate. But,
what you were talking about yesterday. Yeah, I mean, what authoritarians do throughout history is when they come out to give an announcement of news or press, whatever you would call it, they do two things throughout history. We've seen this. They surround themselves with supporters. They mm-hmm. never come out by themselves. Mm-hmm. They surround themselves with supporters. The supporters stand behind and clap and smile and nod their head at everything that they say.
Right.
Then they take people from the area that they're visiting, whether it's a school or a business, and they surround the press corps with those people. They vet them to make sure they're all supporters, and they cheer every answer, and they boo tough questions from the press and harass the press. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what he got that from Trump, of course, who would point out the press corps at his rallies and say,
yeah,
there they are,
you know,
the
right.
And so Ron does the same thing. So when they went in there and the guy was there, I think he's 74 years old. He's just sitting there in a wheelchair.
Yep.
He's got a chair. And they were like, well, who are you? You know, you're not part of our cheering section. And he said, well, I just want to sit here and watch. It's a public building. Oh, no. And they arrested him.
They arrested him. They took him away in handcuffs. They didn't have him give him the dignity of using his electric wheelchair that he uses to get around. And it's just horrible. And I did a little looking into this guy. He's up in Jacksonville, Florida is a big state. So that's not my community. But he is very active in the community. And the directives on their website are all about, you know, peaceful protests, peace and love. And basically, you know, that's what it is. And the way they treated him is just horrible. But this is typical. This is what you expect from, look, and it didn't start with DeSantis. I don't know if you remember, again, you're up in Sarasota, I'm in Broward County, but it's 10 years ago now, guy named Alan West was a congressman.
Yeah, sure.
He unfortunately was my congressman. Uh-huh. And he was holding a town hall meeting, what was billed as a town hall meeting. Well, that day, I was guest hosting the Randy Rhoads Show when she was syndicated by Premier Network. So it was a national radio show. And I'm on the air talking about I'm going to go to this town hall meeting tonight with my congressman and ask him to explain his vote, because they had just voted to privatize Medicare, basically. And I want an answer on that. And so I show up. It's at the Calvary Chapel, which is a mega church, and it's packed to the gills with his people. And of course, the pastor of the mega church got out there and gave a highly politicized introduction, which I don't think that's legal, but nonetheless, it happened. And then, a long story short, they get to the question about Medicare, which he doesn't answer. They had changed the rules that day. He had been having actual town hall meetings where constituents could get up at the microphone and ask a question. Well, I guess they knew I was coming. So they changed it that day. So you had to write your question on a card, and his staffers read the question. So there was no interaction, and he didn't answer the question satisfactorily. I'm raising my hand. I'm in the second row center because the listener saved me a seat. He saw me there. He knew I was there. And when he didn't acknowledge me, I shouted out, "How are you going to, you know, how are you going to, you want to put a profit motive on Medicare? How are you going to have an 80-year-old with high blood pressure, obesity, and diabetes, you know, search for insurance?" I remember the exact question. It was 10 years ago. But that was, the crowd booed me down. An off-duty Fort Lauderdale police officer came and physically removed me from the room. And then they arrested me because I dared to ask questions. And they locked me up in the Broward County Jail overnight. It was horrible. But this is their game plan. This is their MO. This is what they do. And Ron DeSantis is just, I guess he read the playbooks and just took it to the next level, because he wants to be Trump. Anyway, not enough about that. Ron, I want to talk about you, because you're really active on the Twitters, exposing a lot of this stuff. But you're a former Republican. You were a federal prosecutor, and you submitted your resignation to DeSantis, right? What happened there?
Well, I mean, I was very upset about COVID policy last year and the way it was being handled, and, you know, throwing the state wide open with no restrictions. And it got progressively worse. I mean, him talking about maybe we shouldn't count a death as a COVID death if somebody has a pre-existing condition, which could be like high blood pressure.
Right.
So, you know, I was suspicious that the stats were being monkeyed with, and I think a lot of us were. And so, you know, I was following Rebecca Jones, who was, you know, saying some of the same things and had been let go by the state. And of course, you don't know exactly who to believe, but, you know, when he raided her house and had FDLE go in there and criminalize
Rebecca Jones, for those who don't know, she was the one who dealt with all the facts, all the figures, all the numbers, the data.
The COVID data.
And
she ran the COVID database for the state and was fired.
Correct. Right, right. And then she put up her own website to put out the information that she said the Florida state government stopped her from releasing. And then they went after her. They raided her house. They pulled guns. Her kids were there. It was just horrible. The story surrounding her has been weird. And as I said to you on the phone earlier, I don't know what's real and what isn't, because so much of the press is in the pocket of, you know, the governor of the Republicans. And they made her out to be this flighty sort of evil sort of space cadet kind of a character. And I don't know what's real. You said she's running for Congress now against Matt Gaetz.
She is, apparently. Yeah, I received a fundraising letter from her.
Wow.
I don't really understand all that. But I mean, my whole issue was I saw the video that she posted of the raid, how it was done. I read the search warrant. I looked at who the judge was who signed it. And there were just too many red flags. You know, DeSantis was out of state. His press secretary at the time, who was later fired, said, DeSantis doesn't know anything about this.
Of course.
You know, and I thought, that's completely ridiculous that, you know, one of his biggest critics who's generating a lot of media attention has her house raided by his own law enforcement agency, FDLE, and the governor doesn't know about it. That was just fantastical. So then DeSantis came back from out of state and said he did know about it. And so that caused me to just resign my position with the state government and with the Judicial Nominating Commission, just because I was just disgusted at that point. That was the final straw for me.
And is that when you left?
Republican.
Okay.
At that time.
So, yeah. So what made you leave the Republican Party?
January 6th, really. I mean, you know, I was openly a Republican supporting Biden throughout 2020. And I had made that decision. I voted none of the above in 2016,
uh-huh.
You know, but still voted all Republican across the board, except for president. And I just made the decision that I had to support Biden, and he was a lot more comfortable for a moderate Republican to support than Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, he pulled a lot of us that Hillary couldn't. And so, the more I got involved and the more I became involved in getting involved in that race, the 2020 race, and trying to convince Republicans to vote for Biden, the deeper I got into seeing how radicalized the Republican Party had become under Trump. And then, of course, January, my intention was to change my registration to independent mm-hmm. after the election. But January 6th happened, and I just said, I've got to take a stand, you know, for democracy.
Awesome. Well, good for you. So now you're a defense attorney, but you're saying you, okay, we were talking about, you and I, off the air, about what a lousy job the Democratic Party is doing. There are things they should be doing to protect us against all this stuff. We went through this yesterday on a show, you weren't here, but my God, after the 2000 election, the Democrats should have done something to say, not even the Supreme Court can come in and stop the count and mid count and appoint somebody president. There should have been election protections put in place then. The Democrats are ineffective. They're just the people that have been the leaders in this party just aren't good at their jobs. And they're also really bad at the messaging. So we talked about, you know, progressive media and the fact that, you know, I'm out here floundering on my own, as most others who do what I do, most other progressive hosts are, because there is no progressive infrastructure that supports progressive media. On the right, you know full well, they're yes. all in. People who do what I do, but with a Republican point of view, are raking in the bucks.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Well, they'd at least be running a MyPillow commercial right about now.
So, they would, yeah. And I'm not.
I mean, I've worked on a lot of Republican campaigns for 30 years. I've now worked on some Democratic Party stuff. It's like night and day. I mean, the Democratic Party, I mean, I'm a Democrat now, so I can now criticize. You know, it's really like herding cats. The Republican Party apparatus is much more organized and disciplined. They kind of put out their marching orders. The people follow those orders. They do what they're told. They listen. You know, Democrats are all over the place. You got everybody doing their own thing. Nobody's working together. There's no coordination. It can be very frustrating. And I think a lot of us ex-Republicans, like the Lincoln Project guys and Bill Kristol's group and me and others, are sort of trying to say to Democrats, you know, we're not trying to change who you are from a policy or ideological standpoint, but from a tactics and strategy standpoint, we need to make some changes.
Right. You know, you mentioned the massive dollars that the Democratic Party spent on Jamie Harrison's challenge to Lindsey Graham. And what's her name in Kentucky? Amy McGrath against McConnell.
Amy McGrath,
who, you know, never had a chance at winning. Now,
never.
If Charles Booker had gotten in maybe a month earlier, he, I think, could have beaten McConnell. Not Amy McGrath. That was what we were talking about. If they wanted a Republican, they'd vote for the real Republican, not a Republican light. So, yeah. You know, but so that you said you reached out to the DNC. They have a messaging problem. They don't have the, I don't know if they just don't have, I know they have creative people. They're just not putting them in the right positions. And there is no concerted energy going at progressive media, social media, all that. And so you reached out to them. You've amassed 267,000 followers on Twitter. That's pretty good for an attorney.
In one year.
In 1 year. Wow. Yeah. I need to hire you.
Well, you know, I mean, I haven't played any kind of games with those numbers. They just came to me organically. In other words, people haven't pushed people to follow me, and I haven't done sort of stuff that people do in social media to artificially crank up their followers. I haven't done any of that. They all just came to me because of what I was putting out there.
And what you put out there is stuff about what they're doing.
Behind the scenes stuff.
Right.
Not, you know, stuff you're going to see on Fox News or anything. I mean, I go inside their meetings and their clubs and their groups and get video and audio and all of that and post it. And that's where they say their most outrageous, crazy things is when they're in their small settings with no press.
Right.
And that's where my team of people, there's three of us, you know, get stuff from. But going back to the Democratic Party, I mean, the Republican Party has well-funded social media people that create lies, disinformation. I mean, a perfect example is last week with Biden, you know, where he's on the conference call with the governors. Mm-hmm. Asa Hutchinson, Republican governor of Arkansas, is praising him for his work with COVID and saying, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're not trying to make this all federal and you're making it a joint state and federal effort. Biden's response was, that's right, it just can't be a federal effort.
Right. You know, and so they took that out of context.
And what the Republican Party did, the RNC took the 5-second there's no federal solution to COVID. Right.
And took that clip out of context,
put it out there. Democratic Party, I responded myself personally with the full clip, put it out there. The Democratic Party did nothing. Nothing. And nobody affiliated with the Democratic Party, I'm talking PACs, did nothing. And so, and all week long on Fox News, OAN, Newsmax, Biden's given up.
Right.
Biden surrendered. There's no federal solution to COVID. I watched it today on Fox News. Well, and congressmen are now saying it. Senators are now saying it. So they've controlled the narrative on that point. The Democratic Party had no response.
That's
the frustrating thing.
It's so frustrating. We need a department that does just what you're talking about inside the DNC, social media, department, and they need to support the people, not only me, there's a bunch of people like me out here that are floundering. We're just drift, you know, we're like the little thing they put outside the car dealers that flips in the wind. You know, we're out here doing our thing without any support from the party. And on the right, I mean, you write a book, they will buy it in droves and give it away to people as, you know, whatever, just to get you on the bestseller list. They go overboard to support the people who carry their water.
They're buying 15 pillows, you know, to support Mike Lindell.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know,
it's
like
insane.
No, the Republican Party understands the value of grassroots activism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they have a lot of conferences and meetings that we make fun of. I hear it all the time from people on the left. Don't these people work who are going to these conferences, and how much are they paying? And it's all a grift. And yes, all of that is true, but it's also effective,
right,
what they're doing. And they sink money into local races, school board races, you know, state rep races, secretary of state races. The Democratic Party, it seems to me that they're fighting from 30,000 feet up.
Well, they are.
No ground game. They're there to raise money and then to hand that money out for TV commercials, and that's their operation. And it's so frustrating.
Right. And in terms of, say, Chuck Schumer picking the candidates who are the worst, least progressive, have the worst chance of getting elected, like Amy McGrath. That was Chuck Schumer's hand-picked choice, as was Kyrsten Sinema. She was his. He discouraged anybody else from getting in that race. He's like, that's our person. Well, gee, thanks so much. So, Ron, you know what? Right now, this is all hands on deck time, because I hate saying this because it sounds like hyperbole, but it isn't. Everything is on the line this year. In this election in 2022, if the Republicans take back either chamber of Congress, the House or Senate, we're pretty much fucked. What is going on is so frightening. And again, I see what's happening in Kazakhstan. I see what's going on around the world. And yesterday we talked about collapse. that is the word that's going on, that this government may very well collapse if they get back in charge. If, God forbid, if Donald Trump gets back in the Oval Office, it's game over. So we don't have, this is no time to, you know, take sides like you're on the Republican team, you don't belong with us. We need everybody to get together and make sure that these authoritarians don't take over. So you said you reached out to Jamie Harrison. Get any?
No response.
Nothing.
No. I mean, the thing that worries me more is Secretary of State races in six swing states.
Absolutely.
Because Donald Trump has endorsed six candidates in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, all the swing states to run for Secretary of State. And they're all election fraud, conspiracy theorists, crazy people. And these are the people who run our elections.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 2020, all six of those secretaries of state stood up to Donald Trump. We saw Brad Raffensperger do it.
Yep.
We saw Katie Hobbs do it in Arizona. They all stood up to him and said, no, we're not doing what you want us to do. We're not flipping votes. We're not monkeying. We're not delaying. We're not decertifying. But Trump is running six people to take the place of, if just one of them wins,
yeah,
or two of them win, I mean, and they just decide not to certify the results of an election because, quote unquote, they want to investigate fraud. It, you know, that's the end. That's the end of the republic.
Right. So,
you know, it's not like they're going to cancel elections. They're still going to hold the elections. They're just going to control the elections.
Of course. And what they're doing now is they're making it so that the people who run the elections in these states run by Republicans can say, well, I don't know, those results are rather fishy. We're going to throw them out and put our own electors in. That's what Trump wanted to do this time. And some, they stood up against him. But now they're putting their people into these positions so that next time they will not stand up to him.
And the Democratic Party will pay hardly any attention to those races. They're low dollar races.
I know.
You don't need a lot of money to win a Secretary of State race.
Right.
They're low dollar, less than a million, way less.
So,
but the party doesn't recognize the importance of those positions.
Wow. It's horrible. So we have our work cut out for us this year. Ron, I'm glad you're on our team. I hope we can stay in touch because I need allies here in Florida because we're fighting an uphill battle getting Mr. Death Sentence out of here. But we need to get rid of him because this is, they're trying to make Florida their headquarters, it seems. So it is very nice to meet you. I'm sorry I'm rushing you off, but I have another guest coming on. But hopefully you'll come back and we can spend more time and really maybe strategize on how to get him out of Florida and turn things around.
We'll get it straight.
It sounds good. Ron Filipkowski, his Twitter handle is just how his name says. I'll put it on the blog at NicoleSandler.com along with this show. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was great to meet you, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thank you, Nicole.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. There you go. Ron Filipkowski. And I titled today's show From the Ridiculous to the Sublime because the world of politics right now is ridiculous. And I say that not in a funny ha-ha way, but in a kind of a funny, really sad way. It's not recognizable. It's certainly not a democracy. And that's why, and I tell you this all the time, that we can't be singularly focused. If all I did was think about politics and moron death sentence and Donald Trump and January 6th all the time, I would not... I wouldn't still be here. I couldn't survive that. So, I make a concerted effort to do other things. And and today we have a guest who will totally not talk politics with us. And for that, I'm very grateful. So let me tell you who's joining us. Let me bring him in. Hey, Ray Richmond, how are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. Oh, I can't talk politics. Oh, my God.
You
can. Sorry,
you can. You, politics no. comes into everything these days, unfortunately. But Ray Richmond, we know from I know from many, many years ago when I lived in Los Angeles and did radio because you were a newspaper reporter. You wrote on television. You wrote about radio from time to time.
Yes, I did.
You covered some of the shows I worked with and stations I worked on. And
yes, I did. I love the radio business.
Do you? I used to love the radio business. The radio business today is nothing like it was when I moved out to Los Angeles in 1987. It's a different world.
No, it's true. I know it. And the podcasts have inherited the earth, and you know, the money is sort of disappeared. I mean, I know there wasn't a huge amount of money to begin with, but it's plummeted from there.
Right. Well, you know, it depends. There was money for big morning talent. You know, if you were a big morning show, you made a lot of money. If you were just a disc jockey later in the day, you didn't do so well, even in LA, which was the number two market. But, you know, it was exciting. And in fact, while I was in Los Angeles, you know, it's so funny. I didn't remember ever having met Betty White. But then somebody I used to work with at one of those stations, it was Channel 103.1, Andy Chanley, I was the afternoon person and I became program director. He was the morning guy. And he and I co-hosted an ASPCA telethon back in around 2000. And I remembered some of it. He posted this picture on Facebook the other day of Betty White. And there I am with my dog, Sandy, who was a fixture in that radio station. She was our studio mascot. But there's me and Betty White. And so at least I felt like, well, I've got a picture with Betty White, which sort of made it not so horrible that we lost her. Although it's still horrible that we lost her. But the reason...
It is. It's very sad.
The reason I bring up Betty White is because... Oh, I put the wrong... a name up there for you. Hold on. Let me fix that. Because Ray Richmond is, that was my first guest. Sorry. This is because I do everything here.
That's all right. I often respond to Ron Filipkowski. So
that's good. You look like a Ron Filipkowski. No, not really. You look like a Ray Richmond. Ray Richmond has a new book out and it is called Betty White. What is it? 100? You tell me the full...
100 remarkable moments in an extraordinary life.
In an extraordinary
life. I wanted to make sure it was the most cumbersome imaginable title.
But the book is great, and the pictures are wonderful. And so what made you decide to write a book about Betty White?
Well, I was actually approached, Nicole, by the publishing house at the end of 2020. And they were like, well, you know, Betty's going to be turning 100 in January of 2022. And let's get ahead of the game. Let's do something that ties into the 100 theme. So we did. They wanted to do something 100. Like 100 great moments, 100 great events. And so it was. And, you know, with every month that she continued to breathe air and walk around, I was grateful. And darn it, I thought she was going to make it. And 17 days short, not so bad.
Yeah. And you know what? If you live to be 17 days shy of 100 and you die in your sleep, that, you know, that's the way to go. That's what she wasn't sick. She wasn't suffering, right? She went to sleep and she didn't wake up.
It's, you know, let's say, Nicole, somebody comes to you with the following deal. You're going to be wealthy. You're going to be famous. You're going to be beloved. You are going to have all your marbles and you're going to fall 17 days short of 100. Would you take that deal?
Yeah. Yeah. It's again, it's not like she was in the hospital suffering. There was, no. You know, and to go back to my last guest, something I forgot to ask him about, just in the recent days, of course, the right wingers have to have something. And they started a rumor. Oh, Betty White died because she got the booster shot. That, my friends, is
bullshit.
It's complete
bullshit.
It's just not true. Thank you.
No, it's completely not true. And in fact, the truth actually is that she didn't get vaccinated.
Really?
At all.
Why?
And intimates will tell you it was because she was tired and didn't necessarily want to have to interact with humanity anymore. So, you know, which is sad, but, you know, she was very frail and was lacked energy and didn't want to have to go. And this gave her something of a ready excuse not to have to go out.
Interesting.
And not to have to be around people and, you know, and simply be around caregivers and beloved pets. But no, she died in her sleep. She went to bed Thursday night and didn't wake up Friday morning. You know, there was another rumor that her last word was Alan before she stopped breathing, you know, but not true. There were no last words.
There weren't. She went to sleep and she didn't wake up.
Yeah, and we don't like that. We like to have some great dramatic movie kind of ending. And but it wasn't that way. She sort of faded out into the sunset. But she went out on New Year's Eve. So everyone was raising a glass of champagne in her honor that night. So she really did have the last laugh.
She really did. And I got to tell you, my wedding anniversary is New Year's Eve. So that's, you know, now, I don't know. I've always felt, and I'm not alone. You know, I say I've always felt this kindred spirit with Betty White, just her love for animals, which I certainly have. And having met her at that ASPCA telethon, I wish I had a tape of it. I used to somewhere. It seems to have gotten lost in the moves along the years, which is too bad. But, you know, how could you not love Betty White? So did you know her? Did you have any kind of relationship with her?
The truth is, no. This was an unauthorized bio, Nicole. And so I didn't really have any interaction with her. I wish I had. By the end of 4 months of research and 2 months of revisions, I felt like she was my best friend.
I'll bet.
I felt like she was my mother. I mean, I had such amazing respect for her. You know, the deeper you look into someone's past, the more you find skeletons, the more you find issues. They were a jerk that day. There were problems. They weren't nearly as pristine and perfect as they appeared. And that is simply not the case with Betty. She was as wonderful as and as glowing and perfect as she appeared. And people don't want to hear that. They want to find out about the negatives. There were no negatives. The deeper you looked into this woman's past and career and personal life, the better she looked.
Yeah. And then you read. So I started reading the book, and the introduction, the first introduction is written by Gavin McLeod, who was Murray, the news writer in Mary Tyler Moore. He went on then to go on to The Love Boat, but I prefer to think of him as Murray. And he couldn't have been more gracious and complimentary and couldn't exude more love if he tried. I mean,
he was wonderful. Oh my! I just felt so grateful, Nicole, that I got that I was able to have two really wonderful conversations with Gavin before he got sick. When he got sick at age 90, he went pretty quickly. You know, he got sick in April and was gone by the end of May.
Wow!
And but he was gracious and lovely and could not have been more complimentary about Betty, and said, you know, I would be just fine if you wanted to use it. When I asked him if could I use it as a foreword, he said, sure, absolutely. I would be honored to have that, to have my name on the cover of your book. And everyone was like that. Everyone that I approached was wildly enthusiastic to speak to a guy they had never spoken to before and didn't know, because Betty opened every door. She was magic.
You know, the other night after she passed away, Hulu featured her episode where she hosted Saturday Night Live. Because I go to Hulu a lot. It's one of my go-to streaming services. And there it was. And it's like, okay, I got to watch this. And I remembered it. I remembered it from when she was 88 years old. There was apparently a Facebook campaign to get her to host Saturday Night Live.
Yes, and pushing her to do it.
Right. And the best thing about Betty White was, in addition to her talent and all that, was that she was in on the joke. She had fun with it. She was happy to be the saucy, irreverent, potty-mouthed old lady and just poke fun at herself at every turn.
That's one of the things that was wonderful about her. You know, people think of her as kind of apple pie, wholesome, but the truth is she was as naughty as they come, and could swear like a sailor when she was off camera. And sometimes when she was on camera.
Right.
She was part of, people forget that, you know, all of the horrible, vile things that David Kelly made come out of that woman's mouth on Boston Legal and The Practice and in his movie Lake Placid. And, you know, she was also part of the Comedy Central roast of William Shatner,
where
she was keeping up with the other roasters and doing, you know, giving as good as she got having a great time doing it. So you're right. She was in on the joke. That was one of the great things, is you always saw that sly smile and the twinkle in the eye. So you knew she was there with you.
Right. You know, I was saying right after she died that when I was a kid, when Mary Tyler Moore was on. So and her character, though she was great. I mean, in retrospect, I watch it and I laugh, but I was too young and her promiscuity really bothered me as a kid. And I'd get angry at her. It's like, what are you talking? You're a whore. What's wrong with you? Stop it. And as I've gotten older, I'm in on the joke now. And she just, the fact that she elicited that from me as probably a 13-year-old just speaks to her excellence as an actor.
Shows what a great comic talent she was. And in fact, people forget that in 1973, when she came into the cast of Mary Tyler Moore for the fourth season of the show, it was already losing a step. They were also losing Valerie Harper to her own show, Rhoda. So they were sort of a little bit desperate, and she came on. It was only like supposed to be a one-shot guest appearance as Sue Ann Nevins. And she just nailed it so much that the writers quickly huddled and were like, oh my God, we've got to put her into every episode now. Mm-hmm. She's perfect. And because they originally wanted to get a Betty White type character for that one shot. And instead they're like, well, maybe we should try to get just Betty White herself. And because prior to that, she had been mostly a celebrity contestant on game shows, and people thought she was out of acting. Uh-huh. And that revitalized her career as well as revitalized the show.
Wow. So now I'm going to show some photos because you graciously sent along some pictures that are in the book. So, for instance, this is the one that for the people who are listening, I'm sorry, come to YouTube or come to my website and you can watch the video of the show later. See the pictures. Here's one of her from page 96 in the book with Murray. This is on the set of Mary Tyler Moore.
There you go.
Yep. And then here she is with Lou Grant. They were such great characters. They were all beautifully written. And very few people, I don't think, can upshadow Mary Tyler Moore, but she held her own and became this force.
Oh, no, there's no question that she gave the show a spark. And, you know, the chemistry she had with Ed Asner on screen in Mary Tyler Moore was a thing of beauty. And they ended up becoming and staying just the best of friends for the rest of their lives. And then that show ends up losing Gavin, Ed Asner, and Betty in the same year. I mean, it was really kind of unbelievable. They were all there at the beginning of 2021 and then all gone. And what an amazing cast that was. You know, if that was the only thing that Betty White had ever done, she would have been a legend.
No kidding. So this ended, and then she moved on. She went to... I guess I'm not clear on the timeline. When did she marry Alan Ludden? Was that later in life?
Well, I am now a ranking Bettologist. I know everything there is to know about Betty through research.
Of course,
she married Alan Ludden in 1963. They met in 1961 on the set of Password, and it was 2 days after his first wife had died of cancer.
Oh my!
He was back on at work taping Password already, and it was kind of a love at first sight, oh my God, moment between them on the set, and he pursued her for a year. She kept saying no, 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 because, you know, people don't realize that Betty had two early marriages that both ended in divorce. No. And she was like, you know, I'm married to my career. This isn't going to work. I don't want any part of this marriage thing. But Alan would not take no for an answer. He literally proposed to her every week for the better part of a year. When she rejected his engagement ring, he wore it around his neck for 4 months. God. Until she said yes. She finally was like, okay, shut up. All right, fine, I'll marry you. And she said to her dying day that the great regret, the only regret she had in her life, was that she played hard to get and made Alan Ludden pursue her for a year when she could have been with him that year.
Right. I read that. You know, I'm looking at these older pictures of her when she was young that you put in the book. Here's one from page 10. This has got to be
stunningly beautiful.
Gorgeous. And yet you tell how when she was just getting started, again, it was before television, and she went on radio because then they were doing radio dramas and things like that. But they... People were telling her she wasn't pretty enough. She didn't look good.
She had a face for radio, right? That old stupid line.
Oh, I hate that line.
That tells you how dumb, how idiotic people can be. Because there was no one who was ever more photogenic and that the camera loved more than Betty.
Right.
And she loved the camera just as much. It was a, you know, truly a match made in heaven from day one. And, you know, when Nicole, when people talk about the first lady of TV, she literally was the first. Mm-hmm. In 1939, she was the first female face on a television screen. In 1939, they did an experimental TV transmission in Los Angeles to see if they could get pictures and sound from the sixth floor of a building down to the first floor. She was part of that transmission. And 2 months later, conventional broadcasting began at the New York World's Fair, RCA and NBC. But she was first. And then in 49, 10 years later, she was in this pioneering show called Hollywood on Television, where she was on the air 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week, live.
That's crazy. Camping. That is nuts.
No commercial breaks.
Wow.
It's a little like a podcast.
A little bit. Like mine. I don't have commercials. But yeah, no. And she was a pioneer. So she pioneered even radio drama. I mean, she was doing that. And then she, one of the first woman on a television broadcast, a transmission, as you mentioned in that experimental thing, but in the early days of TV. And she just kept going. So then, after Mary Tyler Moore, she had a break there, basically, and then she came back for a second round, didn't she?
Yeah, her break was, you know, doing a lot of game shows and parade coverage. You know, she would host the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and the Rose Parade, and then the Golden Girls came along,
right,
in the mid-'80s.
Yep,
and everybody said, "Wow, well, this isn't going to go. Who's going to want to watch a bunch of old ladies in a house in Miami?"
Right.
And of course, they could not have been more wrong. It went against all the demographics, all of the research, everything the TV said was incorrect. And it's still incredibly popular in reruns. And there's not a moment in any day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that you can't find a Golden Girls rerun on the air. But, you know, originally, Betty tried out to be Blanche. Uh-huh. She was, because, you know, that's much, much more
that's
like
her character, right? That's
right. Like, you know, the man hungry, sex crazed babe.
Right.
And she, but Jay Sandrich, the director and kind of de facto casting guy, said, you know what, we've already tried Ruba Clanahan out as Blanche, and it worked out pretty well. Why don't we just try you as Rose, the naive, kind of dumb one? And
right.
they're like, I can't do that. I can't do naive and dumb. He's like, oh, let's try it. Let's just give it a shot. And of course, she nailed it. And it's impossible to even imagine that character now, in the form of another actress. She was, if you look at it, of the four main characters, that she had the most difficult go of all of them, because they didn't write wisecracks and one-liners for her. She actually had to take what was given her and act and form it. It was all in the tone and the way she delivered the line rather than the line itself.
Interesting. I'm going to have to go back and watch it knowing that now. And you know, you'll watch it with different knowledge, with a different ear, with a different eye. We're speaking with Ray Richmond, who has written this brand new book on Betty White, 100 Memorable. I'm not looking at. I don't have a physical copy of the book.
Remarkable moments in an extraordinary life.
In an extraordinary life, right? I'm looking at your bio at the back of the book because I am looking at it on a PDF. So, and I know you from newspapers, from you writing in newspapers when I lived in Los Angeles. But you've written a number of books, and because you reported on television, a lot of them are on TV. So you wrote The Simpsons: A Complete Guide to Our Favorite Family in 1997. So, and yes, it's still on the air.
Turned out to be a complete guide for about 10 minutes.
Right.
The show is still on the air. I thought, well, this is end of season 8. It can't stay on much longer.
And it's still going strong, actually.
Yeah.
Did you ever think it would last anywhere near? No, obviously not.
No,
you thought 8 years.
No. And you know, Tracy Ullman, you know, who put them they started out as interstitials on her show.
Oh, right.
And she's like, mock bitterness, where she's like, I gave birth to those buggers, and do I get a penny from them? You know, book on The Simpsons. I recently collaborated on a memoir with Janice Page, another 99-year-old woman and actress who was very big on the Broadway stage and did movies and such. She's due to turn 100 in this September.
I don't know her. Should I be embarrassed? Who is Janice Page?
No. She's really not really known very much anymore, but she did The Pajama Game on Broadway in the early 50s. She had roles in many movies. Nothing that springs to mind at this moment, but yes, she was very big and quite the starlet in her time. But I've been able to sort of carve out a little bit of a niche, writing books about Hollywood and different personalities and collaborating and and ghostwriting and such. And it's fun. I love doing it.
I'll bet. In 2004, excuse me, you wrote This Is Jeopardy, celebrating America's favorite quiz show. So what are your thoughts about the replacement for Alex Trebek?
You know, they were going to be damned if they did, damned if they didn't. Mm. It didn't matter who they put in there. It was going to pale next to Alex. You know, I think Maya Bialik is good. I think Ken Jennings is.
I like Ken Jennings. I do.
I like Ken a lot. The problem was that they turned it into a derby, you know.
Yes.
And suddenly you had like 20, 30 people trying out for the role.
Yeah.
And I think that that turned out to be something of a mistake. It was sort of a chaotic exercise in hindsight.
And then the whole thing with the other producer guy, who was just a disaster, a walking disaster. And it just, whether he actually picked himself or not, the optics were horrible. He never should have been in the running. Horrible.
No. That was another, and they'll all tell you that now. Yeah. That was a major screw up. But, it's nice to, I have to say, I'm sad about Betty's passing, but it's an honor to be able to have my name on a book.
Oh, I'll bet.
That her name is on.
I will bet.
It doesn't get better than her at this, you know. And the thing is, Nicole, if you think about it, let's say she had passed on in 1984 before the Golden Girls ever hit the air, she would have been known as kind of a interesting comic talent, but nothing.
No, she would have been remembered for her role on Mary Tyler Moore. And then, and she was, and she would have had her place in history, but she wouldn't be the icon that she became.
No,
right.
Then she hit her 90s and continued to work. No, that has never happened before in entertainment history, that someone in their 90s actually has a resurgence. And so now she's up there with really all the great female comics of all time. You know, Joan Riverses and
the Lucille Balls,
Carol Burnett, Phyllis Diller, even Gilda Radner, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Tina Fey, Tracy Ullman, all these people.
Yeah. And you just rattled off the cream of the crop. By the way, speaking of Lucille Ball, because it's a current show, I got to ask you about it. That being the Ricardos. I'm not going to say, what did
it.
You loved it?
No, I liked it.
Oh, you liked
it? I didn't say loved it.
Okay.
I didn't love it. It disturbed me that Javier Bardem seemed a little bit too old to be Desi.
Yes, he did.
And
Nicole
really
Kidman, did you think she was a Lucy? Did you see Lucille Ball in her?
I saw Lucille Ball in her when they were doing run-throughs of I Love Lucy, the show within the show.
Huh.
Not so much when she was playing Lucille Ball.
Right.
But when she was playing Lucy Ricardo in the show,
yeah.
I thought she was good. But otherwise, that's a tough one.
Really tough.
No matter who they got, it was going to be impossible. And, I give them credit for trying. And, it was a tough thing. But anything that really that brings old time TV and that era to life, I admire. I think that there's still a great film to be made about the early days of live TV.
Oh, I'll bet. Well, maybe you'll do that. So one last thing I want to ask you about is the last thing in your bio. In 2017, it says Richmond fulfilled a lifelong dream by writing and producing a stage play titled Transition. It told the story of the November 2016 meeting in the Oval Office between President Barack Obama and President-elect the former guy, some 36 hours after the election. In 2017, Huffington Post ranked it as one of LA's 10 best original plays of the year. I want to see this. Is it anywhere? Is there a recording of it?
I have a recording of it myself that I will send you the link so you can watch it, Nicole. And I would be honored to get your feedback. I'm very proud of it. But in hindsight, I was much too mild about Trump. I turned him into a buffoonish character rather than the dangerous,
evil person,
vile human
is.
Being he turned out to be.
Wow.
And if I had it to do over again, I would make it much more severe about him. But I'm very proud of it. And, I just couldn't believe what could these guys have been talking about when they had that meeting. I couldn't imagine in a million years how Obama could have gone into that room without vomiting.
I was just going to say that, without spewing all over the place. That lovely yellow, should have been vomit green.
But I had a great time doing the play, and it got a great response. And I will forward you the link.
Awesome, I'd love to see it. So, are you working on your next project now? What are you doing now?
Right now, I'm sort of between projects. I'm looking at looking. You know, I've got a I also do collaboration and ghostwriting of family histories and memoirs for people. And I'm sort of working on a few of those right now and looking at my next bigger project. But we're also doing a little revision of the Betty White book. We're going to have a new printing that's going to look more at her legacy at the end of the book from the perspective of her being gone.
Well, the book came out last month. I was thinking it was being released right around the time of her birthday, but it came out at the beginning of December. So it is available?
December 7th, yeah. So we had a little lead-up time.
There you go. Did you ever hear anything from her? Did she see the book? Do you know?
I know that she saw it, and her people were not hugely supportive of the fact that it was you know, a not authorized book.
Right.
They thought they somewhat accused me of having it be kind of a money grab. And the truth is, if they knew how much I made, they would know better than that.
I hear you.
But no, you know, the truth is that this has all been a labor of love and a labor of, for the most part, everyone has been incredibly supportive of it, especially the people who I quote in the book.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear it. And I'm glad you wrote this because she needed, you know what, a send off, and you had it ready made for her. And so I'm glad that this was here so that people who want to learn, and you do, you go through all the years and you talk about, you know, it's, I thought it was going to be, okay, 100 moments, but no, it's the narrative, and you go through her life story basically. And the one thing to take away from it is that she had a wonderful family upbringing. She was the only child, but her parents were very supportive and raised her in a loving, open, supportive family. And I think that makes all the difference in the world.
Everybody will. She told everyone that she had the greatest parents imaginable, and they were full of love and full of dogs. And they would go on long vacations to the Sierra, where they would be in the backcountry for 2 weeks at a time. And she just, you know, it really set the stage for her having the greatest wife imaginable.
Yeah. Well, she will be missed. And again, when I said it makes her passing not so hard, look, losing her is difficult. And the fact that it was the last thing in 2021, it's just a typical fuck you from a fucked up year.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But
the last middle finger from 2021.
Amazing. But 99 years old, 17 days shy of her 100th birthday, to fall asleep and just go out like that. That's the way to go.
It is.
Bravo.
Someone was looking out for her.
Absolutely. Ray Richmond, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for writing this book. I'm enjoying reading it. I'm not through it yet, but I will be because I'm loving it. And it's good to see you again.
Thank you, Nicole. It's wonderful to see you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much. You take care. Okay.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. Ray Richmond. Again, the book, Betty White, the 100 Remarkable Moments from an Amazing Career or something like that. It is on Amazon, so you can get it there. It's also available on Kindle and all those things. So with that, you know, so real quick, Merrick Garland spoke to The Nation today. And he kind of reassured us. All right, Joy, I can't take your call right now because in the last minute, I want to play this. So here's what Merrick Garland said. I'm going to play two clips for you. Oh, I think they're both the same. Well, let's try this one. Here's one, Merrick Garland.
The central norm is that in our criminal investigations, there cannot be different rules depending on one's political party or affiliation.
Nope.
There cannot be different rules for friends and foes. And there cannot be different rules for the powerful and the powerless.
No.
There is only one rule.
Only one rule.
You follow the facts and enforce the law in a way that respects the Constitution and protects civil liberties.
That works for me. And then he said this.
The actions we have taken thus far will not be our last. The Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6 perpetrators at any level accountable under law, whether they were present that day or were otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy.
Please.
We will follow the facts wherever they lead.
Okay. He said wherever they lead, let's hold him to that. Tomorrow is January 6th. Howie Klein will be here because it's Thursday, but we have the first half hour to deal with the day as it's here. And we'll see. We'll just We'll just play it by ear. All right. I hope you didn't mind the diversion into Betty White. I thought we could all use a little, you know, loving diversion before the heaviness of tomorrow, which has already started, by the way. I don't know if we can trust Merrick Garland, but we kind of have no choice at this point. He's what we got. So I hope he means what he said, because he needs to hold them all accountable. All of them. Lock them up, to paraphrase. All right, with that, we're done for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you, as always, for listening. Have a good night, everyone. And I'll leave you with the news. And for those of you watching YouTube, I'll show you some new stuff that I, new works. I've been showing my stuff during as the news is playing at the end. So we'll do that. All right. Take it away, Nicole.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The United States reported 1 million new coronavirus cases on Monday. That's a record-breaking single-day total that could reflect some delayed reporting from the holiday weekend. But it's also likely a major undercount because it doesn't include the many Americans who only tested positive on a home rapid test or couldn't get tested at all. The Omicron variant now accounts for 95.4% of new infections, this according to updated CDC estimates. On Tuesday, President Biden spoke from the White House, urging schools to stay open amid the Omicron wave. A small but growing number of school districts have shifted to remote learning, but the vast majority have attempted to do what the president suggested. New York City's new mayor, Eric Adams, is adamant, insisting that the nation's largest school district stay open despite massive pressure from union leaders to go remote and roughly one-third of parents keeping their kids at home on Monday. Chicago public schools canceled Wednesday classes after the Chicago Teachers Union voted late Tuesday not to show up for in-person work out of concerns that COVID-19 precautions were insufficient. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot said at a news conference that children need to be back in the classroom and insisted that schools were safe with proper mitigation. 73% of the teacher union's members supported the proposal to force instruction online just 2 days after they returned from the holiday break. The union set a January 18th target date for reopening schools. Stay tuned. President Biden also announced that the U.S. will double its order for Paxlovid. That's Pfizer's COVID antiviral pill. The new order will eventually provide enough pills for another 10 million Americans. But they won't be available right away because of the long production time involved in manufacturing this medication. The CDC also updated its guidance on recommended COVID-19 isolation periods after criticism that its last guidance update, announced just last week, was confusing and incomplete. So now the recommendations include a testing component, with the CDC urging people to take a rapid test near the end of their five-day isolation. And if the test is positive, they recommend isolating for another 5 days. If it's not, the CDC still recommends avoiding travel and avoiding places where you can't wear a mask for at least 10 days. Meanwhile, the testing recommendation may be challenging, though, since at-home rapid tests are hard to find. And the Binax Now tests sold by Walmart and Kroger are getting more expensive. Seriously, those two chains are raising the prices. The more you know. Moving on to January 6th, Thursday marks the one-year anniversary of the Capitol uprising. Law enforcement and federal authorities, including Capitol Police and the Department of Homeland Security, are ramping up security efforts around the Capitol. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the country is at a heightened level of threat, but he added that the DHS is not aware of any specific or credible threats at this time. Meanwhile, the House committee investigating the attack wants to speak directly with former Vice President Mike Pence about what he witnessed firsthand on that day a year ago. A similar request from the committee has also gone out to Sean Hannity following the release of more texts between the Fox, not news, not a journalist, and the former guy and his chief of staff as well. Speaking of the former guy, he's now been hit with two new lawsuits from two law enforcement officers who were assaulted by rioters on January 6th. They're alleging that Trump directed the attack. On Tuesday, the former guy also announced that he was canceling the press conference he had scheduled for Thursday on the anniversary of the attack on the Capitol. Trump had planned to deliver a speech about the election and his big lie of voter fraud allegations that fueled the attack. He's now saying that he'll instead talk about the matter on January 15th, his next rally in Arizona. Four rioters died during the assault at the Capitol, and the next day, a police officer who was on the scene also died. Four other law enforcement officers who responded to the Capitol riot later died by suicide. And in a related story, according to a new USA Today Suffolk University poll released Tuesday, most Americans believe U.S. democracy is in danger. More than 80% of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents said they feared for the future of America's democracy. 85% of Democrats said the rioters were criminals. Two-thirds of Republicans said the mob, quote, went too far, but they had a point. 58% of Republicans said President Biden was not legitimately elected, despite numerous investigations disproving Trump's lies about voter fraud. Only about 4 in 10 Republicans remember the attack as very or extremely violent. The power of propaganda. Interstate 95 reopened in Northern Virginia late Tuesday after hundreds of motorists were stranded, many of them for more than 24 hours after heavy snow, ice, and accidents paralyzed traffic on the highway. Motorists stayed in their cars overnight Monday and much of Tuesday in sub-freezing temperatures, many of them without food or water. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.